Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion, corrections, deletions? The only thing I had at the very top, at least of the copy I had, it was minutes of reorganizational meeting, and I think it's just of the meeting. But otherwise, I would entertain a motion to approve them. And all in favor?
Aye.
Okay. All right. Any public comments? I don't have any chairman's comments at present, so I think we'll go on to the presentations.
I guess I'm starting.
All right, Stacy.
For those of you that don't know me, I'm Stacy Wyans, Public Health Community Specialist with the Division of Health. And I'm going to be speaking about the county health rankings that just came out last month. So the two handouts that I'll be referring to are this one, the packet, the county health rankings report for Wisconsin, and then the green, purple summary sheet. And I'll start, I don't have a PowerPoint, so I'll be referring to these two documents. The first is the report for Wisconsin. Last month, the county health rankings came out. As you recall, because I've spoken about this before, Wisconsin has been doing the county health rankings where they rank all the counties based on different factors for years. Within the last couple of years now, though, it's national. So all counties in all states are ranked based on the same measurements and factors, which is very interesting because you can compare yourself to how you're doing, not just in the state, but nationally. So this report is, though, just for Wisconsin, and it goes through basically kind of a history, but on page 3, they do talk about how the rankings are broken down. And this will mirror what we talked about in the summary for Kenosha. So just for some background, they look at health outcomes, health factors, and then each of those, for health outcomes, they break it down by mortality and morbidity. And then for health factors, they look at health behaviors, clinical care, social and economic factors, and then physical environment. And you'll see the breakdown of how percent-wise, how much that gets put into the health ranking. And then you'll see specifically the measurements that they use for those specific things. And you'll see then on page 6, the breakdown for Wisconsin of the rankings. A rank of 1 is what you strive for, that is the best. And Ozaki actually got number 1 for both health outcomes and health factors. And then you can see the breakdown, so on. Now, where did Kenosha land? That brings me to the green and purple sheet, which is the summary for Kenosha County. And what I try to do when I do this every year when they come out is obviously show our ranking for 2013, but then compare to how we did the previous year. And I also include then the national goals of what they want all counties to really strive for. So in the green there is the health outcomes. So again, mortality, morbidity. We got a ranking of 66. We had a ranking of 64 last year. So we did go down, which is not good. We want to go up. You can see kind of why when you're looking at mortality and morbidity, because we went down in both those areas. And you'll see then I have the breakdown of the measurements and then the specific data. So you can really, it really narrows it down to specifically why we ranked, how we ranked. And so you can kind of see there the years of potential life loss. You know, a lot of these indicators were kind of moving down. I'll move into the purple area, which is the health factors. We went from a 60 to a 61, so we did go down, but not drastically. The good news, I guess, in all of this is the health behaviors portion, which is 30% of our ranking. We went from a 48 to a 40, and that is a really great improvement. And I personally like to see that in this area because this is, for Healthy People Kenosha County and a lot of the things we do, this is our focus, looking at tobacco use, looking at BMI, you know, getting people out there exercising, eating properly, really changing their health behaviors. This is what we're looking at. And to see an improvement in this area, there's a light there that I see that we're getting there. I think once we see more of this, we'll see the mortality and morbidity numbers start to improve as well, once we see more of these health behaviors changing. But you can see we improved in the first one, the cigarette smoke, looking at, we improved also in the teen birth rate. We improved in the motor vehicle crash death rate. So those are some of the areas that brought our ranking up for health behaviors. Moving into clinical care, they look at access to health care, quality of care. We went from a 61 to a 62, so we did go down a little bit in that area. One of the new measurements that they've included in this area is the ratio of population to dentists now. That was something that we haven't seen before in the county health rankings, so that's a new thing now they've included in there. Moving on to the back page of this, the social and economic factors. We went from a 59 to a 55, so we did improve a little bit in this area. Some of these things are things that, we can't control a lot with. But to see improvement in this area, again, is kind of a light that we are, you know, we're getting there. We did improve in the violent crime rate. There was some improvement in the population 16 and over unemployed, looking at the children under age 18 in poverty. So some improvement in these areas, which again brought our score up. The last area is physical environment. And there's some new, and we went from a 63 to a 65, so we did go down a little bit in this. There are, though, two new measurements in here. One is, and they've, in previous county health rankings, they've adjusted the measurements. They've added new things, they've taken things out. But the two new ones this year are the average daily measure of fine particulate matter in micrograms per cubic meter. So basically looking at our air. And then the new one is percentage of population exposed to water exceeding a violation limit during the past year. So that's new as well. So that probably brought our score down a little bit, that these are newer things. But we did make some improvements looking at access to recreational facilities and proportion of restaurants in a county that are fast food. We went down in that as well. So in summary, our overall rankings, we did go down, but I'd like to show that we did improve, though, in, I think, the areas that I really like to see, health behaviors and the social and economic. To me, to go from a 48 to a 40 in health behaviors, I really like to see that because, I mean, those are the areas we really are focusing on. For Healthy People Kenosha County, I've mentioned this before, we use these county health rankings in our planning, in our activities. This isn't something we take lightly. It is a snapshot for us, but we do really take this data and take these rankings and use them. So we'll see how we do next year. I can take any questions.
So do you have any questions?
One comment. Yeah. 2 years ago with the health behaviors, we were at 59. Mm-hmm. And now we're at 40. So it is quite an incremental growth. So to have some adjustment in the behavior, I think, is phenomenal.
I noticed under me I have the accreditation update, which I think is a brief update on accreditation. We submitted all our required documentation the beginning of January. And FAB, the board, accreditation board, came back with quite a few questions and revisions, more to do with, they're very specific on things having dates, things not being draft, things having being official health department documents. And so they had some revisions with that we had to go back and change. So we did that. And now we're basically just waiting. They're currently reviewing all our documentation. And not just reviewing it for the surface stuff, like really looking at it. And hopefully the next, you know, the next time we hear, we'll probably be organizing our site review where they'll actually come. I'm not sure how many days it'll be. This is a learning experience for everybody. But it'll be an in-depth review then of everything we submitted. So we're kind of waiting for that. I'm anticipating probably this summer, but you'll obviously be in the loop on when that happens. That's all I have.
Other questions? Okay, then we'll go to the HUD lead demonstration grant.
Here on behalf of the Kenosha Racine Lead-Free Communities Partnership. Since last year when we met, I'm happy to say we have obtained further HUD funding, and that grant is currently underway to make a minimum of 150 homes lead safe, and it is a 3-year grant. To date, we have completed 11 homes with window work and other abatement work. So, say you paint a window today, because of opening and closing, it's chipping and peeling within months. So that for us is an automatic replacement. There are other things, such as, say this wall was coated in lead. It's completely intact. We're not going to touch it. We are going to leave a lead-coated surface behind. If children start playing with a basketball tomorrow and put that ball through the wall, we now have another lead hazard. But when we walk away, that property is lead safe. We have assessed 83 additional homes for renovation, and 20 of those homes currently have a child with a blood lead level above 10 milligrams per deciliter. On the upside, in addition to the abatement work that we've done, we have also certified different personnel, whether they be property owners, contractors, or partners and staff. So between the current grant and the two that we have previously had, we're looking at 755 homes that have been made lead safe. But if you notice the number above, 36,000, is how many pre-1950 homes we have. Lead-based paint was banned in 1978. However, it's pretty much a guarantee if the home was built before 1950 that there's lead-based paint. Between that 1950 and 1978 mark, they started to phase it out. So on the downside, that leaves 35,245 homes left to fix. That's a lot of work ahead of us. So to put that in another perspective, 35,245 homes that more than likely have families with children. In 2006, Jacobs and Nevin did a study that estimates the lifetime cost of a low level of lead exposure at $45,608 per child. So if you look at how many children were poisoned in Kenosha County last year alone, just Kenosha County, just last year, that lifetime cost is $2.2 million. In addition to the housing contributing to that, we still are importing many toys, products from places such as China and Mexico. And the housing market is not where it used to be. It's estimated that 312 homes will go into foreclosure this year in Kenosha alone. And I think the odds are that when they leave their current home, they are not going to go to a nicer place. They are probably going into a more distressed environment, a more substandard housing. Also on the downside, currently the state of Wisconsin has no lead hazard control funding available. CDC saw their funding essentially eliminated. The EPA saw theirs greatly reduced. HUD had theirs reduced. The state has none. On the downside, our testing rates in the Racine area, I'm aware, are going down. Diane's going to touch on this in a minute, but I believe the Mercer County is holding steady. Also on the downside, though, even with that holding steady, the number of children being poisoned within the last 6 months is unprecedented for our area. If the slope is going in the wrong direction. So if we look at how many children live in Kenosha County and how many children live in our target areas that have those pre-1950 housing, we estimate that roughly 11,000 children are being exposed to lead hazards every day. And if you think back to that cost, that was $45,608 per child. Even a fraction of those, the socioeconomic cost would be huge. We really can't afford to not be addressing these issues. So we clearly still have our work cut out for us. We are constantly seeking to educate the public. We have focused groups like Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Week. However, we do general education throughout the year. We do the certifications throughout the year. We continue to look for funding. We are very blessed to have had the HUD funding that we do. We will continue to keep an eye on CDC and EPA and off chance they get reinstated, they have their funding reinstated, and we'll continue to leverage our local regulations and ordinances to address the lead hazards that we can't reach through these funding sources. I'm here for questions now. If you're like me and you think of questions a week from now, I'm at the health department, call the main line. And I think Diane's gonna jump in with some more information on the blood lead levels if there's no questions for me.
Any questions? Go ahead.
You know what? If she can't, if we're having a problem with wireless connection on all non-hardware devices.
Can you get AG data?
Okay. Then I did do a PowerPoint and I have it on. I do have a copy if you all, it was there if you've all picked it up. It looked like this. I'm Diane Bozovich. I'm a registered nurse who works in the public health nurse, and I'm currently working at the Wick Health Clinic, but I am also in charge of the lead program. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the lead programs at Kenosha County Division of Health. Last July, there have been some changes. As of last July, 2012, the CDC changed the reporting level for lead levels. And lead levels in children ages 1 to 5 years are now reported at 5 micrograms per DL. Before that, they've always been 10 or above, and we would then open it as a case and follow up. Now they're asking that all children who have a level of 5 or greater be reported to the health department and get followed for health follow-up. They're also no longer using the term level of concern as they did before. If it was a 10, the CDC had recommended saying a level of concern that you just needed to watch it. That term has now been deleted, and instead you're using the reference value of the 5 or greater to identify all children who have been exposed to lead. And also in the past, lead levels that have been below 5, or have been, I'm sorry, that have been 5 or below, and that's a typo. 5 to 10, for instance, may or may not have been reported to parents. The new lower value means more children will likely be identified as having lead exposure, allowing the parents, doctors, public health officials, and communities to take action earlier. What has not changed in all of this, the recommendations of the CDC, is a recommendation for when medical treatment is advised for children with high blood lead levels. It was interesting too, I found an article in the Kenosha News last week, I believe it was Thursday or Friday's paper, I don't have the date on it. But they have, it said that 500,000 children are likely have lead poisoning in the United States. They're saying that the increase is the result of the government last year lowering the threshold for lead poisoning, so now more children are considered at risk. And the new number translates to about 1 in 38 young children having been exposed to lead. So we will see those numbers probably changing for Wisconsin as well. We started to look at children who had lead levels of 5 or above in last November, and we are continuing to do that. So now what will happen is if I get those numbers, we will refer them to their physician to have a venous blood lead level confirmation done and do some send some information to the parents. I work at the WIC Health Clinic, and I've been talking to people. Parents have been coming and talking to me right after. I offer them the option of going to their physician or having a venous blood lead level drawn then and there. And a lot of times I've had them opting to have that done. Last year, for 2012, we had 3 objective statements. They're remaining the same. And I will follow along in here. Objective statement number 1, the number of children with a capillary blood lead level greater than or equal to 10 micrograms per deciliter in the number who received a venous confirmation test. We had 27 with a capillary greater or equal to 10 last year, and 23 of those received a venous blood lead level confirmation. 4 children did not. 1 had a home visit, but they still chose to just do capillary levels, and 3 were lost to follow-up. For objective number 2, we hit the number of families with children with a venous blood lead level greater than or equal to 10 micrograms per deciliter. The number who received a home visit to provide information on lead poisoning prevention and treatment. So we had the number of families with children with a venous blood level greater than or equal to 10 was 21. 18 of those received a home visit from the public health nurse. 1 moved to Illinois before that could happen, 1 refused to follow up services, and 1 was difficult to locate, and we're still trying to get a hold of that person. And for objective number 3, the number of children with a venous blood lead level greater than or equal to 15 micrograms per deciliter, and the number of environmental lead hazard investigations conducted on their primary residence or secondary properties, including the accompanying work orders and property clearance. We had the number of children in this cohort that had this done was 10. The number of environmental hazard investigations done for these children was 13. And Anna mentioned many times when parents receive the information of a high blood lead level in their children, their first inclination is they want to move. And I've even had some told by their physicians just move somewhere else, but the lower income housing is hard to find that's lead-free. And we've done clearances and made properties lead-safe, but it still is difficult to get people to understand that the risk is reduced. The number of children with a venous blood lead level are of equal or greater to 15 year was 10. None of those identified in this group moved before the follow-up services could be completed. For 2013, since January to date, I've had 10 new cases reported. 5 have been at or greater than 5 micrograms per deciliter. 5 of them have been at or greater than 10. 1 of those still needs to be confirmed. I need a venous blood level confirmation for that. And 1 moved to the scene temporarily. They're looking for new housing and are not sure which community they're going to settle in. 3 of those have been reported to environmental health for being greater than 15. And 1 they were unable to get was Hispanic. Temporarily living with someone else who was renting. They've moved 3 times. We've not been able to get a permanent residence for them. Reported, and so that has been difficult to find. And We had another one that moved before the Environmental Health Services could get to them to Racine, and they're looking for new housing. And then we had another one that was just recently reported that Environmental Health has been able to look up. Do you have any questions on anything that I've reported, Barney?
Any questions? Okay, thank you. And then our home visitation program.
My name is Betsy Smith, and I apologize. I think I put my PowerPoints out after you all had sat down. So I'm passing them around. So this is the team that I work with. We have 6 home visitors and administrative assistant. It's a great staff. Just this morning, I got on here at work, and the CDC had put up in their weekly reporting the importance of teen birth rates. And while they have been falling, there's still a lot of teens out there having babies. And of course, if you have a baby when you're a teen, you're less likely to be able to take care of them. You're less likely to give them a good start in life. And then the other thing that they're really focusing on is trying to prevent teens from having a second baby before they turn 19, which sounds awfully young. And so one of the best things that the CDC says that we can do is to connect them with a program that helps give them information and provide them the opportunity for making better health outcomes, as Stacey is talking about, and that, you know, the goal is to prevent them from having a second baby before they turn 20. So that's our goal. We have 2 programs. For years now, we've had what I'm going to call the traditional prenatal care coordination program. It has worked with women. We get referrals from a number of places, but we work with the women until they're 60 days postpartum. The problem with that is that a lot can happen after 60 days. It's not very long to make a difference in a woman's life. So our second program that we're very excited about is called Nurse Family Partnership. And this program is different from our prenatal care coordination in that you have to be a first-time mom to enter into this program. I think I have this is a short video talking about why we think home visiting is so important. Do we have volume? Stacy's going to help us out here. You might have to escape here. Sorry? Sorry. Or it might be on the wall behind here. I didn't think about volume.
Is that on?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see anything for volume
over
here.
Oh, it's up. Do that. Here, hit escape. Is it going right? I'm sorry,
I apologize.
No.
On the surface, home visiting looks like personal time. Moments. Taken together, that time represents an evidence-based proven strategy to reduce some of the costliest social problems we face. Child abuse and neglect, school failure, unemployment, poverty, and crime. The Pew Center on the state sees evidence-based home visiting as a sound investment of public dollars.
Home visiting programs are voluntary, and they provide new and expectant parents with training and support before the child's birth and after the birth up to age 3, and you know that's a critical developmental period.
Home visiting starts with a new or expected parent who is willing to welcome a home visitor. What often follows are questions and conversation about parenting, education, and about childhood development. And the home visitor, who is often a nurse or social worker, is trained to help.
The one intervention that's been studied that we know that works well, if it's a high-volume home visitor, is trained. We have longitudinal studies to say, again, the returns are short.
I started looking at how do I break that pathway of people coming to prison. And I also found that you can make a difference in society with kids. But
the home visits ended. Results show dramatic reductions in the contact that participating children and their mothers had with the criminal justice system.
The home visiting programs that clearly save the life of a child, and you can see a reduction in crime. If you don't invest in kids, we're going to be forever fighting crime. So why not invest?
Over time, with money saved on criminal justice, mental health, and welfare costs, and with increased employment for mothers and their children, the highest quality home visitation has been shown to deliver an extraordinary return on investment. According to the RAND Corporation, for every tax dollar invested, high-quality home visitation provides a return of up to $5.70.
We don't start here. We're going to pay the big price and failed kids and needing to remediate later at far marginal costs with even a lower odds of success. That is why home visiting is so important.
It's an investment that starts with family moments and yields results that last for families and taxpayers.
Okay, I don't know how well you can hear that, but what I found very interesting is that the one program they specifically mention in there is the Nurse Family Partnership. And that is a program that we received funding for last year. We started it in July of 2012. So going back to the parameters of the women who are enrolled in traditional PNCC, they need to be have Badger Care Plus insurance. We do an assessment, a questionnaire with them where they have like four or more risk factors being low high school education, non-English speaking, perhaps in an abusive relationship, homeless, not enough food to eat. And as I said, we can only work with these women until they're 60 days postpartum. In the Nurse Family Partnership, one of the key differences is that the women are first-time moms. They have found that this is the group that you can make the greatest difference with because they come to it with a clean slate, and they're very eager to learn. A little less rigid in terms of how you qualify for the program income-wise, so we're reaching a greater base of women. The one criteria is that they need to be less than 29 weeks pregnant. If we miss that window of opportunity, they do have the opportunity, if they qualify with the other factors, to go into our prenatal care program. Again, it's voluntary, and the really cool part about this program is that you get to work with the women until their babies turn two. So now you're not just helping them have a good pregnancy, you're also helping to change their parenting choices and some of the lifestyle methods that they may choose. Who do we get our referrals from? WIC is a big partner with us. We now have the three clinic sites in addition to the traditional ones out in the county and NOD. We have the clinic that Diane is working in. KCHC has become a big partner in referring women to us. I think their numbers have like gone up fivefold since last year. They're very excited about this program also. OBs refer women to us, HMOs, and we have a Medicaid coordinator for our area that is wonderful in terms of connecting women who need services to this program. When we get a referral, we make phone calls, we do a follow-up letters. We are gently persistent in trying to encourage people to become a part of this. It's always hard if they don't enroll before that 29 weeks. It's hard because after that, it's a very strict criteria. You can enroll. Once they enroll, if they decide to take a vacation for a little bit or they think that things are going fine, that's great. We find they frequently come back in their third trimester when they get their glucose tolerance test back or they're suddenly on bed rest and now they feel that need to have someone else who can help interpret the system and help guide them into the places they need to be. Our visits are typically an hour to an hour and a half long. We meet ideally in their home, but we're willing to meet them anywhere. We've met on other school campuses. We've met at restaurants. We meet them here at the health department. And as the video showed, we provide information on health education. We try to coordinate with our other caregivers. We try to connect them with community programs. Again, with the Nurse Family Partnership, we're helping them to really start focusing on goals. You know, you have this child now to provide for. It's easier to maybe focus on getting that GED and really becoming part of W-2 or the other programs that the county have to offer.
She helped me get where I am now today. She helped me with school. She helped me getting my own place. she's helped me. I'm not where I am today. She helped me. And I don't think if it was for her, I wouldn't be where I am, because she showed me, you know, the way to go. I learned that I could be a good mother. I did.
So currently we have 96 active clients. This is up from the 40s a year ago. One of the big differences that I currently see between the two programs is that with our Nurse Family Partnership program, we've had about a 10% dropout rate of women who said yes and then decided to change their minds. Typically in the prenatal care coordination program, we have about a third dropout rate. And one of the things I found very interesting is that the nurse family partnership is more structured in terms of like how many visits do you make, how often do you meet with them. And it's actually a more intensive program, which I would have thought that people would have shied away from. But counterintuitively, the having a weekly visit initially is what develops that relationship. And once you get that relationship developed, you really get the buy-in from the clients. And this is where I think the difference is being seen in their lives. They have someone they can trust. One of the nurses had enrolled a woman, and a couple of weeks later, she couldn't find her. She sent a letter. Well, she made a phone call, no response. About a month later, she sent a letter. 5 weeks later, finally, the woman called back. Things had become crazy in her life, but she was willing to come back with her. She's now had her baby. And she said to this nurse the other day, I so look forward to seeing you. I would not change this appointment for anything. And so it's just a really great program in that once you get your foot in the door and they get to know you, it gives you that venue for helping to make real differences in their lives. Other programs that we offer is a home visiting team. We focus on safe sleep practices. We have assist with dental varnishing and with the car seat program. And then we follow up any of the high-risk referrals that we get from different doctors or hospitals after the birth of a child. Getting back to my first point that I had brought up about the teen pregnancy rate. So I just had done a quick search earlier this morning, so I apologize it's not on your handout. But in our prenatal care coordination program, since January, we have encountered 29 women who have been a part of the program somewhere that are less than 19. So again, to be part of the prenatal care coordination, typically you are a second-time mom, because we try to funnel everybody who's a first-time mom into the NFP program. 29 less than 24, and 16 that were over 25. So that's almost 60 clients that we have had some kind of encounter with that are less than 24. In the Nurse Family Partnership, we have 39 clients that are less than 19. We have 28 that are less than 24, and 21 that are over 25. So in that group, there's 57 that are less than 24. Now, if you were to do all those numbers and add them all up, you would find that's a number much greater than the 96 active in clients I had said. And that's primarily because we do have a greater dropout rate in that prenatal care coordination program. While there are 58 women under 24 who could qualify, we probably only have 50% of those. Whereas in the prenatal partnership program, we have almost 100% of the clients, well, 90% of the clients who have originally signed up with us. Questions? It's a lot of information.
Any questions? I have one. How many do you contact for the, say,
how
the 96?
How many referrals do we get?
Or what percentage are you actually getting to move forward on?
I know that last year, typically, when, just rough numbers from 2012, I believe that we have a 25, how does that go? I'm going to get confused now. I think about 25% of our total referrals say yes. And that was primarily with PNCC. And of that, we had 20% no-shows. In a given year, I think, I just did this report, and I wish I had it at my fingertips. In a given year, we had about 1,000 referrals. And our goal is to see 200 women. Of course, now, as our program max right now for a nurse family partnership is that they would like home visitors to have no more than 25 clients. And what's going to happen is that we are going to quickly reach saturation And you have to remember those women are going to be working with their clients until they're two. And so we're right now at about 75% capacity. So that is the big question. What are we going to do when we reach capacity? Because these nurses, these home visitors, will be tied up for the next 2 years. And yet it's very interesting. Gwen will tell you that, you know, there's a little bit of whatever scuffle going on because as nurses, we cost more than someone with a lower education. And yet if you go around and talking to people about home visiting programs, they all look at the nurse family partnership as a gold standard. And so while it costs more, it really gets a really good return. In fact, I just heard recently that Racine was just thinking about seeing if they could find a way to get nurse family partnership in their county. They're doing a different curriculum. They do Healthy Families America, and they use the Parents as Teachers curriculum. So I found it very interesting that they're kind of looking at that and saying, hey, yeah, that is worth an investment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Or? Okay, well then, Cindy, health officer.
Good afternoon, everyone. I just have a few brief updates before we can start talking about the oral health situation in Kenosha County. Last week was National Public Health Week, so it was April 1st through the 7th, and we had our annual all-staff meeting, and the staff received legal advocacy training through legal action. And also, we reviewed the 2012 successes for the health department, and you have a copy of those. So it's a summary of the programs and services that the staff completed last year, or they're continuing in process. Some of the challenges with some of them, and also the successes and awards. The environmental health department, and Mark's here, I have June 1st, is that the start date?
Yes.
Okay. June 1st, Health Space will be started by, initiated in full operation by all of his staff. The lab department, the Coverdale grant is up for renewal, so they'll be submitting another application and will continue to partner with the ME office. The HUD program, March 30th, of this year, they closed out the demonstration grant and they expended all funds, and that was a huge success and also a huge accomplishment. They had some staff that were out that were beyond their control, and so those funds that were allocated for staff had been sitting there, and they had to very creatively, between Anna and our fiscal person, fiscal manager Wayne, very creatively utilize those funds, so Kenosha County did not have to give any dollars back. In the nursing section, I want to mention about Gwen and the Family Reproductive Health Team, their QI project that they conducted last year through a grant process, which Stacy wrote for that grant, and also Stacy participated. But that particular grant, not only had I mentioned that it was going to be, that project was not only going to be presented at the Wisconsin Public Health, the state conference, it is now going to be presented to the National Public Health Improvement Initiative Conference in April, and that'll be in Atlanta. And the presentation title is Wisconsin Department of Health Partnership with Kenosha County Division of Health, Building Sustainability, and how that grant brought sustainability in regards to the project aspects. With our communicable disease team, they've been very busy with active TB cases. Currently right now, they're going to be doing skin testing with actually a Racine client that he works in Kenosha at Visual Path. First, we thought maybe we'd have to do 800, but we've pared it down. We're going to be looking at rooms and start with about 150 employees to skin test. Looking at the line list, most of them that appears have come from Hispanic descent. I think I sent you some information regarding avian flu, page 7 and 9, or is it reversed? It's reversed. 89 and 7. And just heard on the news today that we have cases in the United States, so it didn't take long to come over from one part of the world to the other. Nod. let's see here, they had site visits from our state immunization consultant, and I heard that everything went spectacular with our three locations. Our community health outreach team, which Stacy leads, their LTAR, which is the local technical assistance review, was held in conjunction with the CDC and the state preparedness program. And Stacy had to forward some additional supportive documents, and right now we're waiting for our final Pokemon results of that audit. Fiscal department, we closed out our 2012 revenue books, and due to our fee-for-service items, we exceeded our revenue summary at 106% for healthcare and clinical services. So our staff are definitely providing services and care and maximizing those opportunities for our residents. Staffing, proud to say that we only have one position. I think it's our environmental public health tech that will post. Well, no, we have PNCC, so we have two. That two positions to get going on. And our nurse practitioner will start April 22nd, and she'll be housed primarily at the wellness clinic along with Diane Bosbich. Any questions on that information? Oh, thank you.
Just April the 23rd at 5:30, we'll have a quick symposium. The Kenosha Immunization Coalition will have their annual symposium in the Commons area. You're all welcome to attend. We have some really great speakers, representative from the state, and a pharmacist that will come in and talk about some of the changes and how pharmacy is partnering with the health organizations and systems to make immunizations possible for our communities.
Before we move on, right. The Oral Health Services.
Sure.
Thank you, Dr. Foster, for summarizing the United Hospital System Emergency Department visits at the key locations, and you can see the number of individuals and the amount. Do you have any remarks that you want to make, Dr. Foster?
Not really. I think everybody has. Basically, what I did is I asked the billing folks for the two emergency departments to pick the top diagnoses that would come in for dental problems to the emergency departments. And luckily, it's one billing group for both hospitals, so that made that a little easier. And so this is, I'm sure there's a few more obscure diagnoses, but this should represent the great bulk of the visits.
And the cost.
Right. Now, those are, I guess cost is relative. As I understand it, those are billed charges, not paid, you know, fees, but it gives you a rough idea where it would be at, I guess.
Good. It's very helpful information. And I'll copy you, Stacy, that you can keep it for the Health and People Commission County, too, as relative for our annual reporting. Then, based on some of the questions that the board members had asked regarding oral health care services and the relationship with Kenosha Community Health Center, I collected a variety of information. This health center has been in existence since 95. They have 78.4 full-time equivalents. Last I've heard, they had 20 chairs, and I'm not sure of the number of FTEs in regards to the dentists. Their services, you can see, they've expanded considerably in regards to the hours that they're open. Made quite a few improvements regarding the Census 2000 reporting information. Give you some idea in regards to the population, the poverty level that we're seeing. And currently in 2011, 97% of the patients are below the 200% poverty level, so they're very consistent in regards to who they see. They do see the low income Medicaid and uninsured, and 65% of minority And then in 2011, they reported that 28% are Latina, 17% African American, 20% white. In regards to 2011, the uninsured percent and the insured with Medicaid, it gives you an idea of the magnitude of what might present in regards to the Affordable Care Act. They made a considerable increase, they quadrupled from 2000 to 2008. They had from previous years quadrupled the amount of dental visits or oral health care services. And in 2011, they had 18,000 unduplicated patients. And also it shows you under age 19 are 53% of their clientele. And then another bulk is the 20 to 45, so mostly they're seeing children. Gender is listed. Word on the street for access for appointments is days. Diabetic was able to be seen in days. Otherwise, can be up to several months.
That's kind of the big question there, isn't it?
I think they have to... I don't know that they're tracking that information, and right now they're in transition in regards to leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the information might be a little bit more difficult to get that level of detail. The area is designated a shortage area. You can see the number of dentists in our area. This is now, this is overall in Kenosha County, and the number that have treated at least one MA. You can see that the majority of our dentists do treat MA clients, and that was in 2010.
I don't think that's true.
This is just
the same one patient.
Yeah, one.
I still don't think 68 out of 76 treated a medical assistance patient.
Yeah. So that's what's being reported. So you can see how data can be skewed.
Oh, yeah.
And then in 2011, our dentist ratio, as you can see, for our population, 2,190 per one dentist, and then the Medicaid population, 311 people.
Now, what does that mean?
It means the number of, based on our population, which is almost 166,000, if you splice that, our number of dentists.
Well, I understand the total ratio, but what's the 311 to 1?
Those are our Medicaid clients. If they were to divide those amongst 76, each would have a practice consisting of 311 MA clients.
I see.
And what's a typical practice? Is it
1,500, maybe 2,000 patients?
You can see then we don't have enough dentists.
Well, I kind of disagree with that too, because most people I know aren't busy.
Interesting. And then
so I think and obviously that's an important number, but just because you have a number of enough dentists doesn't mean people are going to access the care.
Correct.
So that's, I think that's probably
correct.
A big component in this too.
Same with medical. It's the same things. The access piece is the issue in regards to either educating people on accessing and what's appropriate.
Or the funding.
Exactly, or the funding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or the number of providers. So it's a whole mix of factors when you're trying to analyze need in a community.
Well, I think if you looked at that number and said, oh, it's underserved, we need more dentists in the community.
So there's further detail. Some of this information I acquired from the Kenosha Community Health Center website, some from some recent grants that they submitted, and they were reporting some of this information. And then the remainder was from the County Oral Health Wisconsin Surveillance System, which we call a COWS report, and you should have a copy of it. It's from the State of Wisconsin Department of Health Services, and it has quite a bit of detail within this report.
Now, is this just for Kenosha?
Yes.
Okay.
So each county can pull up this information.
Okay, well, they've kind of reported emergency room visits also.
This
for,
is where
for
I
2010.
Pulled, yeah, I pulled off a couple of items that were some questions and included it on this summary sheet just for...
You know, the I guess another big question to ask, I kind of totaled this up, but this comes to over $400,000 is, you know, are these people visiting the ER because they tried to access care somewhere else and couldn't, or did they just, you know, not know and go to the ER immediately?
I can tell you in primary care, they'll just show up on a Friday afternoon and they got to access having pain. And so
they didn't,
they can't get into their dentist.
And I guess that's my question, is did they try to access, you know, what the ERs are going to, all right, here's some meds and call your dentist.
Right. What we're seeing is, you know, a portion of our population, because their world is so much different in regards to the stress or their priorities with food, shelter, job, whatever, that when it comes to scheduling appointments, that's a very difficult piece for them. And so then they access the emergency room based on need.
Yeah.
And so I've got, and because the hours are open and available, they know they can go there 24/7. And they don't have to think about scheduling, remembering, going on a specific date. We typically see with health check anywhere from 30 to 50% no-show rate.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we have walk-in clinics. Mm-hmm. Rather than scheduling, there's many health departments, they schedule appointments. We don't find in our community that would be that would behoove us. So that's the end of my report.
Yeah, John,
just to coattail what you're talking about on that, the statistics that are in here, you have a local association.
Mm-hmm.
Do all the dentists belong to it?
No.
Do they provide any of their own data internally? Do they make up any kind of reports?
There aren't any reports or statistics. You know, I can just tell you from kind of talking to people that the majority of dentists aren't seeing any medical assistance patients. I don't know of anyone in Kenosha.
Because of the return.
Because of the low reimbursement rates. The low reimbursement rates, and again, I think because, you know, again, when I kind of, whatever, a few months ago or whenever we had the meeting, I was kind of shocked to hear that there was still an access to care problem for kids. I assume that this big clinic certainly would do that first. And I guess in my mind, you know, that's what I would think their dental department, their primary goal should be, to treat the most vulnerable population, being kids. So, you know, my question would be, well, why aren't you? So the, you know, days to several months, boy, that's awful vague.
I don't know if that would be overall, all
well, and that's you know, and so I'm hearing that. Stories where, well, no, you know, this patient couldn't get in for, you know, you can't, you know, when somebody calls and their child has an abscess or a toothache, you can't wait days.
Right.
You know, if they have 20 chairs, and I, you know, again, I don't know how many dentists I've heard, you know, 5, 6, 8, you know, if you can't see a kid, you know, I can't imagine how many of those calls they get a day, but, you know, it would seem to me that would be your primary goal, would be, well, let's see this kid first. So I guess that's the problem I have, is, well, why aren't they taking care of that problem first?
They did work up an agreement with the unified school system, and they provide a dentist and a hygienist that'll take care of the schools. And they have been doing some on-site sealants, and then the dentist will do the assessment.
That, you know, that's nice, but you need education and comprehensive treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand that the patient population, you know, a big issue is just education. And, you know, I guess that's only going to go as far as it can possibly go. But, you know, by just giving some kid a sealant or fluoride varnish, you're not really fixing the problem. You know, you're putting a little Band-Aid on it. So without treatment, that's not really going to fix the issue. So I guess I would say, I still have questions. You know, before we move ahead and pass some resolution or try to actually get something to happen, you know, I'm still looking for more more specific examples of, you know, okay, so-and-so couldn't get in for this date, or, how many of these emergency room visits were children that tried to get in and couldn't get in?
I don't think we're ready to make a motion.
No.
It's still not clear, I guess, exactly what the problem or the magnitude of the problem is as it relates to the kids, the adults. So,
well, you know, I guess a thought on that is, you know, I don't know. You know, you say you try to get some of these numbers. Well, you know, I would think there's someone at the Kenosha Community Health Clinic that is looking at this, that should have these answers, that can say, yeah, we get 100 calls a day, kids with toothaches, you know, we're overwhelmed. Somebody must be in charge of looking at that. So, you know, I think the answers are out there.
I would guess, it's just a guess, but that a lot of the kids just plain aren't captured. I mean, I'm just looking back, and it's been 100 years since I was in pediatrics, but when you said that, we just never get called, or we never got called for kids with toothaches.
Right.
That doesn't mean they never occur, and I'm sure dentists would get more, but that just rarely happens. So there's probably a lot of kids out there with bad dental health that never have an event that causes them to go. I mean, for the 1,100 folks that went to the two hospitals last year for, I bet a very small number of kids.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
so,
Glenn, you mentioned, I think somebody else did too, about some situations where kids couldn't get in and were sent to Children's or different places like that. I guess my question is, well, how did that happen? How did it get that bad?
I don't know. Since I've been working at WIC, I know 2 weeks ago I saw a little boy with the whole left side of his face swollen, and talked to the mom, and luckily she said he had an appointment Friday with Kenosha Community Health Center. She called and took him right away that morning. They saw him, put him on antibiotics, and we're going. Then was
so in that case, he did get the appropriate care.
Correct. And then I spoke to another parent with a 4-year-old. They offered to do dental varnishing, and she told me no, she was going to the dentist tomorrow to have 4 root canals because she was born with cavities. You know, it's just you get a lot of.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
And there's a lot of parents that I've come across who don't. You know, you see some of these teeth that are worn down to the gums, and you know that they've had pain at some point in time, and just were not taken in.
Well,
I'm wondering, their triage is always fluid in regards to staff. So maybe drilling down a little bit more and asking more questions,
well, that's,
and bringing it back to you.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
Yeah, I would be willing to do that.
Okay.
I'll make sure that, you know, I have a conversation at least with someone there specifically so we can get numbers like, you know, how many phone calls do you receive, how many clients are you not able to get because of, you know, your schedule.
You hear stories or at the dental meetings and, you know, but that's, you know, I don't know, that's hearsay. I don't know.
My question, I guess, is from a private perspective, how would we capture those numbers of clients that would call some of the dentists in the area and then were turned away because they don't have the insurance or
I don't think anybody's going to turn anybody away because they don't have insurance. You know, they're going to say, well, come on in. Mm-hmm. Well, do you take medical assistance? No. Mm-hmm. So. You're not going to turn them away, but they're going to be unable to accept the medical assistance.
Okay. Well, they won't be able to accept it to be able to pay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, again, this was kind of based on, you know, the discussion, and I know in other states, and this is something that the Organized Dentistry, the Wisconsin Dental Association, has worked on for years and years and years, kind of trying to get the legislature to increase reimbursement rates for medical assistance, particularly for kids. And, you know, I can't guarantee it, but I would bet $1 million on it that if you increased rates to reimbursement rates to 90-95%, you would have just about every dentist in, you know, in Kenosha in the state that would say, send them over. Of course I'll take them. So, the WDA and we have legislative days and I think we just had one, and you know, people go to Madison and talk to people, and I participated in that, and you know, the legislators listen to you and yeah, but you know, what are they going to do? So you know, it occurred to me that maybe this is kind of an interesting approach. You know, maybe it shouldn't be coming from the dentists or the dental association, but wait a minute, what about the county health board? You know, that's going to hold a lot more weight, I would think, with the legislators. You know, and maybe this is a problem not just in Kenosha, but in a lot of the other counties. So, you know, this might be a way to approach it and say, you know, this is a public health issue.
Well, from a health department perspective, we saw that even in OB.
Mm-hmm.
Things that you're seeing today,
yeah,
is the, you know, it's,
yeah,
it comes from that, the expansion of that. So I'm thinking that this would probably be very similar to what we did,
mm-hmm,
where we petitioned the state, and eventually they have a specific coordinator, or they call it a navigator,
mm-hmm,
here in Kenosha that works to make sure that all of the OB clients are spread throughout all of the OB providers,
mm-hmm,
which was, it wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking that's a direction, but we would. I'll talk to you.
Okay.
About,
all right.
Just that whole process. Of
all right. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and I think in view of the time escaping on us here, maybe we'll try to brainstorm a little more on that one, and corporate counsel, any.
Nothing.
Okay. Any other business? Otherwise, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. Very good. Thank you.